Welcome to Rights for Women, a podcast all about celebrating women's voices and supporting women writers. I'm Pamela Cook, women's fiction author, writing teacher, mentor, and podcaster. Before beginning today's chat, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, along with the traditional owners of the land throughout Australia. And a quick reminder that there could be strong language and adult concepts discussed in this podcast, so please be aware of this if you have children around. Let's relax on the convo couch and chat to this week's guest. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Right for Women. Today I have a fantastic interview with novelist Donna Cameron. Those of you who have read Donna's latest book, The Rewilding, or perhaps her debut novel, Beneath the Mother Tree, will be familiar with Donna's work. I have had the pleasure recently of reading The Rewilding and absolutely loved it. It's a eco-thriller, really. It's a story centered around climate change, but with a fast-paced action, almost thrillerish plot. And Donna has done a fantastic job of merging her beautiful literary lyrical style of writing with that really fast-paced kind of story. It's a beautiful blend of literary fiction and genre fiction almost. It was a real pleasure to talk to Donna. And let me tell you a little bit about Donna before we start. Novelist Donna Cameron is an Orgy-nominated radio dramatist, award-winning playwright and short film writer. Her first novel, Beneath the Mother Tree, was listed as one of 2018's top Australian fiction reads by the Adelaide Advertiser, was a finalist in the Screen Queensland QWC Adaptable Program, and longlisted in the Davitt Awards. The manuscript of her second novel, The Rewilding, won her a 2020 KSP Fellowship, was runner-up in a 2020 Writing New South Wales Award, and gained her a 2021 Varuna Fellowship. And it has been published this year, 2024, in Australia and New Zealand by Transit Lounge. As I said, I really enjoyed this chat with Donna. I think her style of writing and what we talk about a lot in this interview is how she has really blended something that is crucially important to her in terms of an issue or a theme and really used that as the focus for the story and centred her plot around it. So sit back, grab a cuppa, put on your walking shoes, whatever it is you do when you listen to Rights for Women, and or watch it on YouTube, and really hope you enjoy this chat with Donna Cameron as much as I did. Donna Cameron, welcome to the Rights for Women Convo Couch. It's really great to have you on, especially after reading The Rewilding, which I absolutely loved and I've been raving about to everybody who I've been talking to about books in the last couple of weeks. So congratulations on that.
Thank you so much, Pam. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited and nervous and honoured to be on Rights for Women podcast.
Oh, it's lovely to have you here. We are going to get on to talking about The Rewilding, but before we do get on to that, looking at your website, you're very experienced as a playwright. You've had some short films out. You've worked as an actor. You've trained as an actor. How did you translate all of that into novel writing? Where was the kind of bridge that led you into writing a novel?
There was actually a bridge, and the bridge was radio drama, actually. So I was working as an actor, and I ended up somehow becoming a playwright. It's a long story. But then back when Radio National had their drama department, which it folded up 50 years, but yeah, I had four plays produced on ABC Radio National through their drama department. It was a wonderful thing for writers and actors, and it's so sad that it all folded. But suddenly I no longer had to work just in dialogue. I could do internal voice, and yeah, that was like prose. And yeah, so I really got into radio, and it really opened and freed my writing up. And then when my first book, Beneath the Mother Tree, came to me, it was even more freeing, because suddenly I wasn't just writing for the ear. I was writing for everything, all the senses, and I was hooked. And I knew then, I was like, oh my God, I found my form. I should have been writing novels all along. What have I been doing with my life? I fell in love. I absolutely fell in love. I found my joy.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I love hearing that. So did that story come to you as a novel, Beneath the Mother Tree? Is that the kind of form that it appeared in your psyche?
Yeah. And I knew it wasn't a play. I knew it wasn't a radio. By then, the radio department had folded. And, this thing came at me and it was so big. And I was like, whoa, this is a book. And I just felt like I was flying. Do you remember? You have written so many books. Do you remember your first book? I'm only up to my third. And it's such a, I don't know, there's something really special about the first book. Just so exciting. And ignorance is bliss.
It really is. It's really good advice to anybody out there working on their first book. Really enjoy that process because so many other factors start to come into play when you get down the track.
Ignorance is bliss. I just was in bliss. I was like, whoa.
And so you obviously really enjoyed that process of writing the novel. How do you think your playwriting and also your acting experience, how do you think that kind of has informed the fiction writing side of things?
Yeah, very much, because as an actor, you're sinking into character and looking at the psychology of a person. Then as a novelist, you get to do that with not only one person, several people within the book, and you get to act them all out and understand all their psychologies. You can do it in your pajamas if you want it.
Yeah, one huge advantage.
It's all about psychology, isn't it? Understanding the human condition. And I just love people. People are endlessly fascinating.
That's a big part of what I love about the novel writing process too, is really thinking about why do people behave the way they do and what makes them tick and how does your past inform your present? It's just fascinating. So tell us a little bit about Beneath the Mother Tree. That was your debut novel. What was that about and how did that end up getting to a publishing contract for that?
I think I have the rockiest road to publication than I've ever heard, and I've met a lot of writers now. Yeah, strap yourself in. So Beneath the Mother Tree is the question that drove me. When I write books, it's a question that I need to explore. And the question that drove me for Beneath the Mother Tree was sense of belonging. I was lucky enough to grow up on Kwandamooka country. And so I naturally went to school with a lot of Indigenous people. And I always wondered about my connection as a fourth, fifth generation Irish, mainly Irish, Australian, a bit of Scottish and English as well, but mainly Irish. And compared to the direct connection to country that the Indigenous people had and have. And so I was exploring that in the book. That sounds really dry, but it's really just
a murder
mystery set on a subtropical island. But anyhow, I wrote this thing and it was 110,000 words. I had no idea what to do with it. I had no idea about the publishing industry. I listened to a podcast. Maybe it was you and Kel. I can't remember. But I just realized I've got to get an agent. So I Googled, I thought, who's my favorite Australian writer? Kim Winton. So I Googled Tim Winton, agent, and up popped Jenny Darling. And I looked on her website and submissions were open. And you had to send in the first three chapters and a cover letter. And I think I sent in the weirdest cover letter. It was something like, always wanted, I found my form and novel writing. Just nothing to do with the book.
Enthusiasm.
You must have thought I was like 18, where I was actually like much older than that. Anyhow, I got a request for a full manuscript request like 2 days later, and I sent that in. And then 2 weeks later, I got the email with two readers' reports attached, and she said, I'm very interested in your book. However, it's too long. You need to cut 30,000 words off it. You need to look at your comma placement. And because I had no idea about comma placement. I'd been working in dialogue for years, and
of course,
my head wasn't around all these prose things. So, yeah, there were two readers' reports attached. You said read through them, take everything they say on board, and I want you to rewrite it. And she was very lovely. She said, take your time. I had no idea. She was saying, you get one shot, give it your best shot. I was just dancing around the house saying to people, I've got Tim Winton's tune. No idea. You had to sign on the dotted line. And until you do that, they can just turn around and say, thanks, but no thanks. Anyhow, I did not do everything she said. I think I cut about 10,000 words off it. And she asked for 30,000 words. Mm-hmm. Comma placement, I had no idea. So I just went through, and everywhere I took a breath, I just put a comma. So I made it much worse. So I just thought, I can't keep her waiting. This is exciting. And I sent it back quite quickly. And of course, she said, oh, thanks, but no thanks. Best of luck.
How disappointing.
I know, but it gets worse.
Until.
And then, yeah, somebody in the industry read the manuscript and they approached Meredith Koerner from Penguin Random House and said, you've got to read this manuscript. And Meredith said, yeah, sure. I ended up printing the manuscript out and going into Sydney. I live like an hour and a half from Sydney, but I caught the train in and I just had fantasies that I'd meet Meredith and it would all be so wonderful. And Meredith, of course, there was just some woman at the front desk who said, oh, I'll get this to Meredith, don't worry. But I had incorrectly typed my email address incorrectly on the front of the manuscript.
No.
Yeah. By then I was listening to heaps of podcasts and I was like, don't hassle them. And my friend was like, just leave her. She'll get to you when she gets to you. And so I learned that it could take up to 6 months. So I waited 6 months and then eventually I emailed her and it's like, oh, I'm just wondering if you had a chance to read my manuscript. And she said, oh, I read it within a couple of weeks of receiving it. And I was halfway through when I emailed you, but I never had a response to my email. So I stopped reading because I assumed you didn't want to work with me.
Oh, no, Donna.
I know.
God. You must have been absolutely dying at this point.
I was a bit suicidal, I think, really. But yeah, anyhow, the week later, I won a residency at Varuna and I took Meredith email, I took the reader's reports from Jenny Darling and I got it down to 80,000 words and I learned how to edit and it became the manuscript it should have been. But by then I'd sent it out already to all the slush piles. So I was down to just all the little publishing houses and I ended up got three offers of publication within 3 weeks with all the smaller publishing houses and I went with Midnight Sun and yeah. Anyhow, that was my journey to publication.
Wow. I have not heard a story like that. That is definitely unique.
I keep thinking when people say, oh, yeah, oh, it was really hard for me. I'm like, you got nothing on me, babe.
Yeah. I can trump that. So when Meredith said, assumed you didn't want to work with me, whatever, she didn't then, was there any further conversation about her looking at the rest or?
Yeah, I emailed straight back because she forwarded me the email that she'd sent, which basically said, I'm halfway through. I'm loving your book. Would you consider cutting exposition? There's too much exposition at the front half of the book. And I never received the email. So she stopped reading. And then I said to her when we finally made contact, I said, look, of course I would consider. I said, I'd consider cutting off my right hand if it meant being published by you. I'm so sorry. And so we had a few emails. She said, look, I'm so busy. She's like five books
in.
And we kept trying to email and she kept trying to make time. It just got really awkward in the end. And in the end, another book came out that was set on an island, Kangaroo Island. Mine was set in the Moreton Bay Islands, but and had Indigenous content. It was similar, so it fulfilled that. Do you know what I mean?
It was timing.
It was a little bit similar to my book, and I could see it wasn't going to happen. I felt like I was hassling her in the end.
Mm.
She was being so lovely, but they get so busy, and you need to hit that point with them. And anyhow, I am a fatalist, so
yes,
my journey is a different one, and I'm sure it'll all end up absolutely getting better and better all.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you find that experience of having your first book out in the world?
Well, it was amazing. Yeah. And it was so interesting because the goalposts change all the time, don't they? Mm-hmm. Idea of success, because you hold it in your hands and you think, this is success. And then you get your first major review and you think, this is success. Yeah, yeah, it's a very interesting experience.
And when that book came out, Beneath the Mother Tree, had you already started on the rewilding? Were you straight into the next book? How did that process work for you?
So seed for the rewilding was planted actually while I was working on Beneath the Mother Tree. And I went to see Tim Winton speak, and I was going to meet him for the first time in a little hall in Wynnum Manly. And I had my copies of The Riders, which was my favourite Tim Winton book. But right at the end of the conversation, he said this really weird thing. He said, I never thought there'd come a time when I'd start lying to my children. And the interviewer was like, why are you lying to your children? And he said, if your house is on fire and your children are looking to be told that everything couldn't be okay, of course you're going to reassure them. You're going to lie and reassure them and tell them that everything's okay. Like basically not that we're all going to die. And it was a typical Winton. He was talking in metaphor about climate change. And I didn't meet him. I was so upset because I knew how well connected he was to scientists. I knew how well read he was. I knew how intelligent. I'd fallen into enough of his words to know that this man had his finger on the pulse of the planet. And I just walked out into the car park just going,
oh, wow.
And then the next day I had a phone conversation with one of Australia's leading entomologists, Dr. Stephen Doggett, who was giving me research for Beneath the Mother Tree because one of the lead characters is an entomologist. And I told him what Tim Winton had said. And Stephen said to me, yep, so glad I never had kids, without hesitation.
Oh, God.
And I was just, I'm a mother of two. Yeah. I was just like, what? Oh.
And I've got goosebumps, actually. It's
I know.
So confronting,
but
isn't
I
it?
I pushed it down. I was like, I was writing Beneath the Mother Tree. It leaks into Beneath the Mother Tree because the protagonist, Ayla, she comes back to the island because she is really depressed about what's happening on the planet and everything. It's all there in Beneath the Mother Tree, but not as such as it is in the rewilding. The seed was planted back then, but the rewilding didn't happen until... So my third, which will now be my third book, I was actually working on that. I was first draft into that. I'd finished the first draft. And then the rewilding came to me and I was like, nah, I know about the shiny new thing. I'm not going there. But the rewilding it screamed at me in the end. I had to write it. So I abandoned Bloomfield, which I've now gone back to, and I'm editing madly, and hopefully it'll be finished soon. But it screamed at me.
Yeah, I can understand why, Donna, because there's so much in here to do with climate change and the emergency, really, that the planet is that we're in. And I'm going to get on to talking about that. But just for anybody who's listening, could you just give us the rundown on the rewilding, on the plot, your elevator pitch?
So it's about a whistleblower, Jagger Eckerman, who blows the whistle on his multi-millionaire property developer father's business activities, and then he freaks out, so he goes to hide out and lay low in a cave in a national park, which is north of Sydney, a cave he found with his mum when he was a kid. And he doesn't realise it, though, that the cave's already occupied by an eco-warrior, radicalised eco-warrior woman, Nia Moretti, and she's hiding out for reasons of her own. She's up to all sorts of illegal protesting activities. Mm-hmm. And they end up trapped and on the run together, and all sorts of things happen. Yeah, it's a chase thriller, and it's an odd couple love story, and it's a love song to our planet.
Oh, beautiful description of it. It's, for me, a really beautiful blend of beautiful lyrical literary fiction and that pacey thriller. You've managed to really blend those two forms. So well done.
Thank you. That's my thing that I want to do.
Yeah, but you've nailed it.
Because I read literary fiction and I love literary fiction, but I hate the lack of plot. And I'm just like, why can't we have both?
Yes, exactly.
We have both.
As I mentioned at the beginning when we first started, I've been raving about this book to quite a few people, including my Patreon supporters on Rights for Women. And I've been telling them that
I love you.
I really think that the first chapter of this book is like a masterclass in what to do in a first chapter, because you have this amazing opening sentence. You've got this fantastic hook at the beginning of the book, which we're going to get into talking about. And all these kind of seeds planted, pardon the pun with the rewilding, but all these seeds planted in that opening chapter that just compel the reader to keep going and find out more. Before we actually get into talking a little bit more about that, I wondered if you would mind reading the first couple of paragraphs, Donna, just so people can get a bit of a taste of what I'm talking about.
Sure. I've never actually read the opening. I've done quite a few author events lately, and I actually choose to read the part where Nir and Jagger meet. So I've never actually read the opening. So this is the first time. The first chapter is called Out of a Puddle of Stinking Silt. The instant he ruins his life, a vision of his mother explodes in his head. He can't see her face, yet he knows she is smiling. Flyaway wisps of hair flare in the light, and she is gone, leaving him blinking at his computer screen. Then the guillotine click of the mouse as he opens the sent box, hoping it has failed. But there the email sits, silent and lethal. He hits delete, owning the futility, knowing his world has come undone. Through the glass panel in the hallway, the light above the elevator dings to life in his every nerve ending. The shock of truth has robbed him of time, robbed him of lucidity. He's caught scrambling to his feet as the metal door slides open and Ed steps out in all his rotten triumph. Jag, you're in early. What happened? Shit the bed. Jagger can't speak, his voice trapped down a dark well.
Fabulous. That was really good.
Thank you.
A few things I want to talk to you about there, Donna. One is at the beginning of your chapters, you have these little kind of subheadings or titles. Some of them are quite quirky. So in this one, it was Out of a Puddle of Stinking Silt. Did you have those there as signposts for you as you were writing and then they stayed? I know that happens with some authors. What's the story behind those?
At first I didn't have them, and then I started to go, I just don't want chapter two, chapter three. I thought, maybe I'll just choose a line from there. So at first, no, I was just choosing a line. And then as the book progressed and I started to edit, I was choosing a line that kind of summed things up for me. Mm. Yeah.
They're great. And I think they act as really great hooks too, because they've all got that little bit of edge or inbuilt conflict in them that makes you think straight away, wonder what's going to happen in this chapter.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. I think because I was writing for radio, I'm really aware of the audio form, and I started to think, chapter one sounds so boring. Mm. You know what I mean? So I started to think, how can I change that up a bit? Yeah. Do you find you're writing more for audio now? I find I'm starting to consider things as I'm writing, so audio in mind. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, my backlist has all been over the last kind of year, 18 months, has been converted into audio. Thank you. Yeah, it's been really exciting to have it out in audio and to creators and things like that.
I can imagine. Yeah. But audio is huge and it's getting bigger because we're so busy. Everyone is listening rather than reading. My children, they're young adults and they would rather listen than read.
Yeah. I listen to lots of audio books. I do all my book club books on audio. Yeah, in the car, on the train, wherever. When I'm out raking paddocks, I've got an audio book on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just getting better and better. Yeah.
Doing the dishes.
As authors, Donna, we're very aware of how important the opening is. And we're told, make sure that your opening is really up to scratch. And then we work on that opening chapter. How different is your opening chapter to the original one that you would have first drafted?
That was the original chapter. In fact, I didn't really change much. That kind of came, that first chapter. And what happened was the actual story starts when Jagger's fiance, Lola, he opens the door to their apartment and hears her talking about how she stalked him for his money and breaks his heart, basically, which sets him off on the whole journey. And I tried to write it from that point. I thought, oh, otherwise I'm going into flashback. I need to. So this was always the original first chapter. And then I tried to change it because I didn't want to do flashback. But it just didn't work. It did not work. It didn't have that oomph that I wanted. So I just went back to the original chapter. And the reason I wanted to start with an oomph is feedback from Beneath the Mother Tree. I know writers hate good reads, but I love good reads because I learn where I stuffed up.
Okay.
And
okay. That's a great way to look
thing,
at it.
Yeah. The big thing that I got was lots of wonderful reviews, but it took me a while to get into it. I kept hearing that. Oh, it was a slow burn at the start. I almost gave up. I wasn't. But once I was hooked, I was in there. I thought I just started that hook too late. And so I was really determined the second book. I thought, okay, I'm just going to get right in there and start with that action straight away. But yeah, so what happens is he gets on the train and he's heading up to where the cave is, and then he flashes back to walking in on Lola, and we realized how we got to that point to send the email. So I started with sending the email, but I didn't set up how we got to that point. And yeah, so I had several drafts of trying to be really logical and linear, but it didn't work. I just have to do the flashback. And I think it works with the flashback because I just got really clever about it in the end. And
it works too because of where he is when he's having that flashback, isn't it? He's on the train. It's a natural point at which he would sit there and think about
reflect.
What just happened. Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind when we're doing flashbacks and backstory and things, is inserting it in the right play.
Yeah. But I, as a writer, I started to learn, wow, opening pages are so important. I had no idea. And I realized as a reader, I judge a book by, I read the first line, and if it doesn't turn me on, I'm just like, then I might give it a paragraph. And then I'm just like, put it back on the shelf. So it's brutal, isn't it?
It is, but that's what we really need to be aware of, isn't it? We need to bring our reader's mind when we're at the, particularly at the revision stage. But for me, when I was reading this, first of all, that opening sentence, the instant he ruins his life, like already within the first four words, that word ruined is just, oh, okay, here we go. So evocative. A vision of his mother explodes in his head. And I think this is a really great example of how important word choice is. The vision of his mother doesn't just appear or hover or whatever. It explodes in his head. And then you go on, he can't see her face, yet he knows she is smiling. We've got that vision of her and then she is gone. Even though you don't tell us there that the mother is, I don't know, is it a spoiler to say the mother's dead?
Not at all.
No.
That all happens before the story.
I don't know. Something about the description there that you gave immediately gave me that clue that he's pining for his mother. There's this sense of yearning for his mother. You set up so much in this opening paragraph. And then, of course, the email being sent and him immediately wishing that he hadn't pressed send and that sense of trepidation that he has. You've captured it all in that opening paragraph. And I think, you know, your word choice there was the email sits silent and lethal. He hits delete, owning the futility. Knowing his world has come undone, and even that phrase there about the world coming undone is so prophetic in terms of what the whole story is about. So just total kudos to you, Donna, because I think it really is just so skilled. You've really...
Oh, can we just talk for 3 hours? Can you deconstruct my whole book?
I actually love doing this, and this is something I tell my students to do, is to get books that you're enjoying or that you love or your comp titles, books that you think, oh, I would love to write a book like this, and to really sit down and pull them apart and have a look at what the author's doing, because I think we can learn so much from that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I didn't even realize as a writer that I had written He Ruined His Life and then His Mother's Smiling. And I thought later, wow, that's really an interesting tension already happening, that his mother's smiling because he's ruined his life. And as the story goes on, of course, you realize, yeah, he's ruined a life, one of his lives.
Yeah. I could ramble on about your opening chapter for ages, but I just urge everybody to read it. Let's talk a little bit about Jagger, because the name is immediately interesting. And his situation, obviously, is precarious right from the very, very first kind of sentence, really. What was the inspiration for him and how did you develop his character? How do you go about your character development?
I've got to say all of my books so far have come to me in what I call a whoosh. Jagger arrived and his mother arrived, his name, and I don't know where they come from. To me, it's like big magic. Yeah, I can't explain it, but everything arrived in a big whoosh and I have to take notes, just dot point notes, and they don't make sense. But I get plot, I get the characters, I get the ending, all arriving at once. And all my novels so far have arrived like that. I've got notes for my fourth novel now and it arrived the same way. Yeah,
I love
very
that.
Weird. It's exciting when it happens.
Yeah, I bet.
And then you're like, oh, I know all the work now.
I know.
Oh, God. Years of work that are going to happen because of that little arrival.
And do you then get to know, does the writing process itself then allow you to learn about the characters and they're developing as you do the writing?
Yeah, absolutely. And they surprise you. And sometimes you have to change them to, it's half craft, half magic. Yeah, because sometimes, like Nia, for instance, in the first draft, she was just up on her. So Nia's the radicalized eco-warrior character, just for the readers. She was up on her soapbox in the first draft and, yeah, she was just raving like a lunatic about what's happening with the planet. And my first readers were like, oh, I couldn't stand that character and I skipped over all those bits. And so I just had to pair her back till she was minimal and then she was much more powerful. It's interesting.
She's still got that edge, hasn't she? She's still pretty full on as a character.
She's much better than she was. So,
but you need that because that's the kind of interesting relationship that develops between her and Jagger. But she also has a point of view, not as many point of view scenes as Jagger. When you were writing the book, obviously it's mainly from Jagger's point of view. Did you write the whole thing through in his point of view and then go back and add the Nia sections? How did that process work for you?
No, they came all in logical order, but she had a diary entry between every one of his chapters originally, but it was just too much. So I just got rid of a lot of them.
Yep.
I was very much inspired by Hope Farm by Peggy Frew.
I haven't read it, but I have heard of it. Yeah.
There's these beautiful diary entries that happen in that book. And I just thought, it's such a wonderful way to get a second voice in there, a really powerful way inserting that first person. Because first person is, I don't know, it's uber power compared to third person. Even though Jagger's third person's very close, there's nothing like first person.
Yeah, it's interesting to have that mix of the two. When you're writing, Donna, how do you go about developing the backstory and the psychology of your characters? Or is that part of the whoosh and it's just there and you're uncovering it?
Yeah, I think it must be part of the whoosh because I don't do exercises or I don't know. I work a lot with dream. I do work a lot with dream, middle of the night stuff. I like to early hours of the morning, still half asleep, pull my laptop into bed and start writing in that half dreamlike state.
Great.
I don't know. I just, that subconscious stuff, that where that magic is. I like to tap into that. Yeah. I don't know how it all happens. That's what I love about it.
Of course, the other, which we touched on earlier in the conversation, the huge theme in this is climate change and the state of the planet, and that is very much the story that Jagger gets pulled into, even though there is already a connection with that for him at the beginning. As I was reading it, I thought of you as the author, and I thought how much research you must have done to really get all that into the story. And you did it in such an interesting way because it became part of the dialogue or part of a character's thought process or whatever. But also how disturbing it must have been for you, in a sense, writing it. Like you said, you had that initial reaction to Tim Winton's statement when he was speaking. How did you cope with that as you were writing it?
I had to write this book to cope, if that makes sense. Every book so far, it's actually just been about exploring a question. And for me, I was in an incredible state of climate grief. So Tim Winton set me off. But then it just got worse because I started just reading then, and I realized how bad things were. And then I had to write the book to find hope. I wanted hope. I wanted to know if there was hope, if there was a possibility that we could turn this around. I need to manufacture hope. And yeah, I did a lot of research, and I came across the work of Joanna Macy, who's a Buddhist scholar, writer, and she talks about maintaining the gaze. And maintaining the gaze is really hard because there are days where you're just like, can't do this. But to not do that is worse for me, because just trying to ignore it, you can't, because it's there in your subconscious and it rises up anyway. So it's better to maintain the gaze, to walk straight into it, open-eyed, and deal with it, I think. And I think as a species, we actually need to do that. I think at the moment we do have our heads in the sand, and subconsciously as a species we're screaming. We're all like this because we're not dealing with it. We're just open-eyed. We need to go, okay, actually collapse is occurring right now. What can I do as an individual? And that's what I really wanted to explore in the rewilding. There is so much we can do as an individual. So we can't sit back and go, oh, I'm just disempowered. It's all up to the governments. Because if we wait for the governments, we're not going to save ourselves. But it's so weird. I keep thinking that John Lennon is going to have a comeback. Power to the people. Imagine that. Do you know what I mean? I think we will get to that point as a species. Humans are incredible. We are just the most beautiful, compassionate, creative, or one of the most beautiful species on this planet. At the moment, what we're doing is we're actually destroying so many other species as we speak. But I think we have incredible compassion. And I so wanted to weave all of that into the book, all the good stuff we're doing. And we can tap into that, and we can believe, rather than feeling disempowered, because despair is our biggest enemy. If we think we can't make a change, we will just go, oh, whatever.
Give up.
Whereas if you go, oh, maybe I could look at my superannuation fund. Maybe I can look at my bank. Maybe I can divest. Maybe I can look at my food sources. Maybe I'll grow my own food. I'll buy from my local farmer's market. Maybe I'll buy a hybrid car or an electric vehicle. Maybe I'll drive less. Maybe I'll carpool. You know, all these little, if we all did that. Imagine if the whole of Australia suddenly divested super bank power companies overnight. We just all went, no, we're not going to support fossil fuel anymore. What an incredible thing that would be. We are capable of doing that. I wanted to capture that feeling in my book.
You definitely have. And it sounds like the writing of it also inspired you to just continue on with that kind of mindset and to share that mindset. And I think that's a really important message in the book too. Without being, it's not preachy, it filters through the story because it permeates pretty much every aspect of the story. But I think you've filtered that message through there really beautifully.
I found the answer to my question through writing the book. Hope comes through action. That's what I realized. I got to the end of the book and I was like, I felt so good when I was writing the book. And then it went out on submission and I started to get really depressed again. And I realized, it's because I'm not actively pursuing. When I was writing the book, I thought, this is good. I feel like I'm doing something. And then it went out, and then I was like, oh, I have to actually keep doing something because otherwise all this despair is going to come back. So, yeah, in my own life, I've become a red rebel, which is exciting.
It's very exciting, very inspiring. What would you say was the biggest challenge for you, Donna, in writing the book?
Not becoming didactic, not getting on my high horse. The first draft was really me just venting, yeah, and then I had to get rid of it all.
What about the biggest joy? What did you find the most joyous aspect of writing?
The love story between Nia and Jagger and the humour that
they've got great banter
as they get to know each other and the way she dresses him.
There's some really funny moments in there.
His shoes and the way that he ends up, like his beautiful business suit, Armani business suit, just gets tattered as the book goes on. And to me, that's a symbol of capitalism just getting destroyed. And yeah, that was all of that was so much fun. Yeah.
It would have been fun. You had those really lovely layers to the characters, even though they were in these at times quite dire situations. One of them had make some smart ass comment and it'd be a bit of banter, and it just was a really lovely balance.
Yeah, it's the best, isn't it, when you crack yourself up, you're just sitting there laughing your head off and hoping that maybe some reader might find this funny.
I do.
Same happened with Beneath the Mother Tree, the grandfather character. I was cracking myself up writing that role part character, and you just hope that it comes off the page. Do you know what I mean? You never know whether it will come off the page. But
it's the same with the other emotions, isn't it? If you find something in the story particularly emotional and it brings you to tears, there's a strong likelihood it's going to have that impact on readers, or at least on some readers.
That's such a skill, I think, to make a reader cry.
Yeah. I always feel happy when readers say they've cried in my books. I know that's a little bit sadistic, but sorry. Donna, in the acknowledgements in the back of the book, which I always love reading acknowledgements, I often read those first and then I go back and read the book and then I read the acknowledgements again. But there's a lot of kind of people in the industry, friends and writing friends who you acknowledge. And it struck me, and you may even have said this, but it's a little bit like that idea that writing a novel is a bit like raising a child, that concept that it takes a whole village. Would you agree with that in the case of this book?
Definitely. So I submitted the manuscript to Curtis Brown. I just submitted it through the general button.
Oh, okay.
And Benjamin Stevenson, I think he gets the first manuscripts or whatever, and he read it and he sent me the most beautiful rejection. I've actually printed it out. So beautiful.
He basically said, what was the gist?
It said what you said about that I can write literary, but I still have that page turning. I should have had it in front of me. I could quote it to you, but it was so beautiful. But he also said, stakes aren't high enough. And at that point, I didn't have the hitmen in the book. Jagger was just running because he was scared that what his father would do and maybe he might get arrested. And it was vague. And Benjamin Stevenson gave me that because it was like something in my brain just dropped. And I was like, oh, he's not running for solid reason.
Yeah.
Luckily, I got a residency at Varuna and I went for 2 weeks and I wrote that whole, you know, I've probably given things away that I shouldn't, but yeah, the hitmen. I wrote the hitmen and that changed everything. It changed everything. And that was an agent who just took the time to write me a detailed rejection. So agents out there who do that, thank you so much.
Fantastic. And what other sort of feedback did you get along the way as you were drafting and revising the book? What other sorts of feedback did you get from people?
Yeah, so my writers group up here on the coast, they're fantastic. And I'm lucky enough to have Anna Downs in my writers group.
Brilliant.
And she was just like, where's the sexual tension? And I was like, it was like another penny dropped. Yes. They so have to be sexually attracted to each other and it really annoys the hell out of them right from the start.
Yeah, yeah.
And that changed everything in their relationship.
And do you use beta readers, Donna? Do you have people absolutely that read at different stages?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I've got to say, with Bloomfield, which is my third book, I haven't. It's interesting, as you get more experienced, I'm holding off this time because I feel like I'm a bit more all over it. But I know it's getting to that point where I will need readers soon. But I used to get readers in earlier, and I haven't with the book. Yeah. I've heard that happened. Yeah.
Yeah. And how
about you? Books.
Yeah, I always get people in my writing group to read it. And because there's eight of us, it's great because you can give it at a certain stage to
certain people. Yeah.
Certain people.
Yeah.
And then, or if you want particular feedback, like you were saying, Anna's got that great eye for probably the thriller plot and the that sort of thing. So there's different people with different skills that you can give the manuscript to at different times, which I find really helps as well.
Yeah.
So this one has been published by Transit Lounge.
Yes, which I'm so honoured and privileged. I couldn't believe it because I just thought there's no way Transit Lounge would pick me up. They publish such good writers and I just didn't think I was in that league. So I'm gobsmacked.
That's amazing. And what sort of reception has it been getting? Like you said, you do read Goodreads and you're really aware of what reviewers are saying. Have you been happy with the reception so far?
I'm actually, I thought that being such an unusual book, it might get ridiculed or, it's been amazing. All the reviews have been incredible. Just writers that I really respect saying incredible things. I'm just like,
That's great.
It's interesting. A lot of it's about confidence, isn't it? Because you go through these bouts of, I'm sure you do, and we all do, where you just think, oh, I can't write, really.
Yeah, I know.
And then, your new book gets received so beautifully. You just think, oh, actually, maybe I can do this. And it really helps with your next book as you're working on it. That voice in your head's just going, actually, it's all right. That's a really good passage. Own that. And it helps having a publisher like Barry Scott, who's just, he's so in my ballpark. He's just, he's so supportive of my writing. And that makes such a difference, having someone backing you like that.
Yeah. You've got that person there championing your book, which is exactly what you want. Do you have an agent now, Donna?
So I did end up getting an agent for The Rewilding, but it took a long time. I had a year of rejections. I think I tried every agent in Australia and they were rejecting it on the premise because no one wanted to know about climate change. They said climate change doesn't sell. Publishers don't want anything to do with it. It won't sell. And the same thing happened with the publishers. Nothing to do with climate change. It doesn't sell. So, 2 years of rejection, basically. Yeah.
Go you on keeping going with it and being really determined and just persevering and getting it out there.
Well, I would have self-published if it hadn't got picked up. I'm not writing for the accolades. I'm writing from this strange space. I think we're in a very odd time in history at the moment.
That brings me to my last question, which is what I like to end the chat with, which we've touched on. But what would you say is at the heart of your writing?
Joy. Yeah, I do get off on it. But also there's always a question, a burning question that drives me to actually pursue a book because it's a big thing, isn't it? I'm not a quick writer. It takes me years. It's a lot of work for no money. You've got to have some burning thing that's driving you to. And for me, with Beneath the Mother Tree, I wanted to know how I belong here. The Rewilding, I wanted to know if there was hope. Bloomfield, I want to know about community, whether that will save us, whether we'll be kind enough to each other.
Oh, I love the sound of that. I'm really looking forward to it. And I am going to go back and read Beneath the Mother Tree, not having read that one yet. So now that I've read The Rewilding.
Well, or you could wait for the audiobook, which hopefully if I get my ship together, will be out soon.
Okay, brilliant. So tell us a little bit about that. You're recording that yourself, or you've recorded it already?
Yeah, I have recorded it at Argus Studios in Mullaney. I'm producing that myself, so I'll be hybrid. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. And who will that come out through, Donna? Or are you, like, how does that?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out, all of that. Yeah. I don't know how to do all of that.
But you've already recorded it?
I've recorded it and I've listened and, yeah, it's ready to go. It's hot off the press and I just need to know how you, what you do with it now.
That's so exciting. All right. Well, I better let you go, but thank you so much for being on the pod. It's been such a great chat.
It's been so lovely. I'm just feel so grateful. Thank you. I hope maybe someone buys my book.
Oh, I'm sure they will. And I, as I said, I'm out there spruiking it. Thank you so much. And
thanks, Pam.
Good luck with the next book.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Rights for Women. I hope you've enjoyed my chat with this week's guest. If you did, I'd love it if you could add a quick rating or review wherever you get your podcasts so others can more easily find the episodes. Don't forget to check out the backlist on the Rights for Women website. So much great writing advice in the library there. And you can also find the transcript of today's chat on the website too. You can find details on the website on how to support the podcast through Patreon. And you can connect with me through the website at rightsforwomen.com, on Instagram and Twitter at W4WPodcast, the Facebook page Rights for Women, or find me and my writing at pamelacook.com.au. Thanks for listening, have a great week, and remember, every word you write, you're one word closer to typing the end.